Coffeehouse Shots is sponsored by Look Forward, the podcast from Rathbones on what the future might look like. Find out more at rathboneslookforward.com. Hello and welcome to Coffeehouse Shots, Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Katie Balls and I'm joined by Fraser Nelson and James Forsyth. As Italy reopens shops and restaurants and hair salons today, the UK government is facing struggles when it comes to sticking to its own, more gradual timeline. James, over the weekend we've heard more reports of the struggle when it comes to whether or not schools will be able to reopen at the beginning of June, as Boris Johnson said he would like to happen when he set out his roadmap. Does it look as though there is much chance of this going ahead?
Well, the beginning of June is now only 2 weeks away. And unless dramatic progress is made this week in terms of the teaching unions becoming reconciled to at least reception and year one and year six going back as the government would like, it is hard to see how that can happen. And I think there is the challenge here. You know, you heard Michael Gove saying, Sandra Marshall, you know, he was saying, look, I can't say that this is 100% safe, because the only way you could say people would be 100% safe if people basically stayed locked down in their houses forever or until everyone has been vaccinated. And I think this is the challenge, which is the lockdown has kind of flipped the burden of proof. So you now have to show that something is safe, and it is very difficult to show that something is completely and utterly safe. Now, the medical evidence seems to suggest that, first of all, kids themselves do not seem to get the disease severely, and there also seems to be, although this is a new disease and one has to caveat everything, there also seems to be a sense that children are not the super spreaders of the disease that people thought they might be at the beginning, and so teachers going back to work would be at no more risk than someone in manufacturing or construction who is going back to work. I think there is also a kind of moral case here. There's some work out from the Institute for Fiscal Studies today showing that kids from better off backgrounds are getting 30% more lessons at home than kids from deprived backgrounds. And I think there is a real question here, which is you could be about to massively widen educational inequality if we end up in a situation where schools don't go back until September. Remember, you know, for a long time, lots of academics have thought that you should chop the school the summer holiday in two, because the summer holiday results in kids from educated households coming back at an advantage from those kids who don't have parents who have the time or the ability or the space to kind of push their kids on schoolwork during the holidays. And so I think we are at quite an important moment here, because if schools do not go back until September, then I think you really will see a big educational divide opening up that it will be very difficult to close even when the schools return.
Fraser, where's the political pressure here? James is talking about increasing levels of inequality, yet is it still the case that the general position from Labour is not pressurising schools to reopen? In fact, the pressure seems to be going the other way, to keep them closed for longer.
I think that's a very good question in general. Where is the pressure on the government coming from? I think there is a divide at the moment if you're basically lockdown sceptic or cautious, hawkish or dovish. I don't know what you want to call it. On the hawkish side, we can see lots of Tory individual backbenchers, people like Steve Baker and others. We can also see Jonathan Sumption, a former Lord Chief Justice, and he has been very eloquent in saying that he doesn't think the lockdown works, that it's causing a lot more problems than it's solving. He was on the gave an interview to the BBC yesterday where he gave a pretty devastating critique of the government's logic. And when I heard him, I thought, if that were Keir Starmer, then the government really would be in some trouble right now. If the government were being attacked for what lockdown is doing in damaging children's education, in causing permanent damage to the least advantaged, in entrenching inequality and worsening inequality, it would be very vulnerable, because lockdown is doing all of these things. I actually can't think of many things that are more socially regressive than a withdrawal of state support from the people who need it the most, at a time where children in wealthy two-parent households are way better placed to be getting good homeschooling. So, strangely, at a time where their most opposition is needed, is not really being applied. And I think that Gavin Williamson is actually quite lucky that harder questions have not been asked about his stewardship as Education Secretary of this. For example, where are the inspections? In the leading article of The Spectator last week, we pointed out that the inspectors should be every day coming up with tests to find out which schools are giving proper homeschooling and which aren't, because the varying standards is absolutely shocking. You get some kids who are given eight classes an hour, each one with at least 15 minutes of FaceTime with a tutor, and other kids who are just go to Google Classrooms with a list saying, here's your homework, kids, good luck, and get on with it. So at a time where scrutiny has never been more needed, it simply isn't being applied by the opposition. Keir Starmer is trying his best to point out flaws in testing, etc., but the government is not particularly exposed there. It is exposed in the social and economic legacy of a lockdown which is increasingly looking like it was the wrong remedy for a problem which disproportionately affected pensioners and the over 60s.
James, when it comes to a route out of lockdown or a place where we can live with the virus and have some form of normality, test and trace is seen as very crucial to this. We've also had some news yesterday that should a vaccine become available soon by this Oxford University study, the UK would be able to mass produce it. But it's still the case that test and trace within government is regarded as the most likely way to getting us to a point where we can resume some form of normal life. So how are we getting on with that? Because there have been reports over the weekend that those who are being recruited for it have been told that actually the government's moving to a different app, but the government have since said that was just simply an error of a message.
Yeah, I mean, the big question we wait to see is whether the testing app that the government has decided to devise itself rather than using the Apple or Google, they jointly developed Apple and Google one, whether it works, frankly. Alert, for example, was meant to be an acronym with the first A standing for the app, but the app, you know, the app is not yet ready, and so Alert was not an acronym. And so I think we wait to see what happens with the Isle of Wight trial and whether the app succeeds or not. It is obviously, I think, The government policy has been devised at the moment on the basis that there is no guarantee that there is going to be a vaccine, and that, you know, that you should be cautious about it. So it is much more about trying to learn to adjust to this new reality rather than hoping that the vaccine is going to turn up and solve all our problems. I think if this Oxford vaccine that Sarah Gilbert and her team are working on, if that does work, and the government's ability to ramp up vaccine production, that will count as one of its successes in this crisis, because this country has gone from being in a position where it's had no significant domestic ability to produce a vaccine to the ability to produce 30 million doses on a very tight timetable. But again, all that is dependent on the Oxford vaccine working, and we cannot be certain about that yet. And I think the government messaging on this has got slightly mixed, which is you've got Boris Johnson stressing that there is no guarantee of a vaccine anytime soon, and then a slightly different tone from the business secretary, Alok Sharma.
Another interesting point of this is that we're almost told that because the government's putting 60 million quid into this vaccine, it's more likely to happen. And the moment you start reading headlines about how there's going to be millions of this available in September, the more you think, oh, the government's basically is raising expectations here, because the odds on this happening are pretty slim. There are something like 100 different vaccines in trial right now. I heard a government minister quoted this morning saying Britain will be first in line for this, and I don't see why morally that should be the case. If Britain invents a vaccine that works, the recipe should be made globally available, and then every country should be able to make the vaccine to its best ability, in the same way that if China invents a vaccine, by the way, more money on China doing so than England, I imagine that the formula will be widely shared, and the people to get it will be the countries who've actually got vaccine production facilities. So I think that's probably as important as putting money into research. Either the Oxford idea will work or it won't. Doesn't matter how many millions of pounds you put in behind it, but it will matter if we're able to produce these vaccines. That's where I think government money will be well spent, because we can't produce vaccines at the moment.
James, we know the government is putting a lot of time and effort into test and trace. The Scottish government too is starting to look into trials. But given that we think around a third of those who have coronavirus are asymptomatic, how is that compatible with a system where you have to report symptoms?
Well, I think the idea of is that you want to be able to do mass community testing as well. The current medical thinking, and it's worth remembering this is a new disease, so the thinking evolves, is that people are basically most infectious about a day or two before they display symptoms. And I think the idea of track and trace is you can then, as soon as people display the symptoms, you can then track down who they have been in contact with and try and get a grab on this. Now, the next point, I think, is that one of the arguments that is in, I think we'll hear a lot more of in the coming times, is that you need mass community testing to go alongside track and trace so that you can try and deal with this issue of asymptomatic transmission. I think if you look at the disaster that is unfolding in care homes, I think part of the problem there was that people didn't appreciate that the disease could be spread by people who were asymptomatic. So if you had people who were normally in a care home but were in a hospital for medical treatment and they weren't displaying symptoms, it was thought that it was perfectly safe to send them back to their care home, when actually, even though they were asymptomatic, they could be contagious.
Now, finally, Fraser, I mentioned in the introduction that in Italy, for example, today we are expecting restaurants to reopen, though under new guidelines. And it's a similar picture across all of Europe, with, I think, a lot of countries get opting for a faster easing of lockdown than the UK. How much do you think this is going to dictate the UK response going forward, if the R number goes up quickly in these countries? Do you think the UK government is going to be more cautious about things they said they might try and do in June and July?
I'm afraid that I think we're going to be last in line to reopen our society and economy. It's funny that when the R number goes up in Germany, it makes news in Britain, but it doesn't make news in Germany because they don't think it's the best way of judging the outbreak. They look at the number of infections per capita. In London on Saturday, there was one person diagnosed with COVID. So in London, in general, the virus is at well below safety levels. So by logic, you ought to be starting this experiment in London. But I think we're going to end up going around in circles if we keep applying logic to the government's position. I think politics has taken over instead. And the politics is this, that after we misjudge this virus so badly and failing to realise that the care homes would be so badly affected, and failing to realise that locking down the working age was not the solution and protecting the vulnerable pension age was the solution. We've made so many mistakes. I think the government feels like it's almost lost the right to be bold when it comes to getting out of this. So I think we will be looking to see what's happening in Denmark, what's happening in Germany, what's happening in Italy, and be seeing if any of these steps see a recurrence of the virus. Because in all of these countries, the infections seem to be following a fairly standard asymmetric bell curve in their shape. We haven't really seen it resurge anywhere, and maybe it won't this time around. Maybe it will, maybe it is petering out. And the big question is, will there be a second wave and when it will come? So I don't think we should expect if we want a haircut, I think we ought to probably be, or a holiday. Italy said it's going to reopen its holidays now. That's one of the things it's doing. I don't think we can expect it here, really. I saw in my local barbershop, it's got a certificate in the window saying it's been approved by something called Barbicide for COVID haircuts. Now, Barbicide sounds like death by barber. I'm not sure that's the greatest brand name for barbers opening up their things. But I think that we're seeing more optimism amongst British retailers, pubs and barbers than the government is likely to share. During the weekend, we had Dr. Jenny Harries in the weekend briefing said something very significant. She almost seemed to mock the R number completely. She was saying that the idea of having one R number is like saying that everybody lives in exactly this house because that's what the average house looks like. She was saying that the R number was different for hospitals, for care homes and for the community, that we are not looking at one COVID outbreak, but three COVID outbreaks. And it would be stupid to judge the education in one part of the country by what's happening in care homes in the other part of the country. She is making the case for a regional road out of lockdown. She said at one point that she didn't want to put ideas in words in ministers' mouths. In other words, she almost sounded like she was openly advocating abandoning this idea of having a nationwide R strategy and moving to a regional strategy which separates from the regional R figure the infection rate in hospitals and the infection rate in care homes. Now, that sounds to me like a very sensible idea, but I don't think it's going to be adopted by this government, which is incredibly cautious in its road out of this situation.
Yeah, James, just finally on that, Jenny Harris, she's saying that reducing cases is the focus, not the R rate. So do we have a situation where the Prime Minister's outlook is different to that of Public Health England's?
I think the combination of new cases and the R number is the key, because if the track and trace capacity is not to be overwhelmed, you need to have got the number of new infections down to a manageable level so that you can then trace everyone that they have been in contact with. So I think you need the number of new infections to drop, and then you need to keep on top of the R number. I think there is an issue, as Fraser said, there's not only a regional R number, but we seem to need almost three R numbers. One is R in the community, one is R in care homes, and one is R in hospitals. Because the argument that we've heard in various other countries where they've been following that R number is, and we know that this is the case here too, that the rate of infection in care homes can be pushing up the nationwide R number. Now, given that it is possible to isolate out care homes and offer them specific support, I think it would be wrong to base the entire nationwide policy on what the R number is in a care home, rather than what the R is in the community. And that, I think, is one of the difficulties here. I also think there is another kind of interesting question here, which is, as Fraser said, that the pattern of the disease in terms of not the height of the spike, but in terms of what happens after the spike, does seem to be relatively similar in lots of places. And again, this is just one of those things. This disease is so new that we don't quite seem to understand what is going on with it. But I think what is clear is that for the government's chosen route out of lockdown to succeed, you do need the number of new infections to drop from where they are now before it can work.
Thank you, James. Thank you, Fraser. And thank you for listening. Coffeehouse Shots is sponsored by the Rathbones Look Forward podcast. Join the world's leading thinkers, writers, and scientists discussing the future of our ever-changing world. In the latest episode, historian Tom Holland talks to broadcaster Andrea Catherwood on the future of morality. Find out more at rathboneslookforward.com.